This is Tracing Architecture, and this is a podcast about the layers of architecture of our industry, our profession, and our art form. My name is Sean Swisher. I'm going to be one of your hosts.
And Matt Tien, co-host.
And I'm James Wessel, another co-host.
We thank Pella Windows for their generous support of this podcast. And if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast yourself, feel free to contact us at tracingarchitecture.org or our email address, tracingarchitecture@gmail.com. This show is sponsored by AIA 10 Phoenix Metro. AIA 10 is what's known in other parts of the country as the Young Architects Forum or Emerging Professionals. It's architects in their first 10 years of licensure. And we started this podcast and are sponsored by AIA 10 because we're looking to investigate and explore issues that are important to our AIA 10 members as well as other groups. History is rooted in the analog, paper and parallel bars, while the current trends and future of the profession lie in the digital, rapidly advancing what is possible in the built environment. This dichotomy often also represents a major cultural schism centered around the role and definition of an architect in the past, present, and beyond. And we've invited a roundtable to discuss their various perspectives. Joining us for this episode is Eddie Jones. He's a local architect and the founding partner of Jones Studio. Also, full disclosure, my boss. Also joining us is Marlene Amertzian, FAIA. She is the founding principal of Marlene Amertzian and Associates Architects. We also have Matthew Salinger of CoLab Studio. He's an architect and artist in Phoenix. And what we try to do in inviting these three people to our roundtable, we wanted to get a variety of perspectives, people at different points in their career, but also that their work is particularly focused on craft, on the small details of things coming together. And so we wanted to discuss how that idea has changed throughout their careers and where they see it going.
We also brought them in to kind of discuss from the point of view of people who have been very successful in their own right in bringing what we feel is a quality craft to their work and starting to understand how we can work to accomplish that ourselves in our own careers.
And craft is really a delineation of our process. And we really wanted to talk about how these different processes could produce such great architecture. And that's where we produce this dichotomy of the different opposing or different interconnected ways of how these crafts are created.
I'm Marlene Amertzian, and I'm principal founder of Amertzian Architects in Phoenix, Arizona, and Escondido, California.
I'm Matthew Salinger, one of the co-founders of CoLab Studio, also a partner in Valley Homes Development Company.
I'm Eddie Jones. I founded Jones Studio in 1979.
All right. And then just for the full gamut here, I'm Sean Swisher, project architect and designer at Jones Studio, full disclosure. And I'm also the AIA 10 co-chair for Phoenix Metro.
Okay, so our first question for today. This episode, we're contrasting two veins of craft, analog and digital, and we can talk about the merits of splitting it in that way, but that's at least the framework we began. So when we say analog and digital, what we mean by that is the analog being things that we create with our hands and our bodies, and the digital being what we develop through computers, through an outside assistance beyond the human body. So compared with where you started your architectural educations and careers, how do you feel that the changes that have gone about in the profession have shifted your idea of that word craft, if at all, or if it's evolved in any way? And then what does it mean to you in your practice? And then lastly, is there a different framework of analog versus digital that we should consider beyond the way we've described it? So, and with that, I'm going to open it to whoever wants to talk first.
Well, I'd like to define or take a closer look at craft. You know, I don't know how you think of it, Sean, whether it's a noun or a verb or an adjective, but for me, it's an outcome. And it's an outcome, you know, the quality of the outcome, the quality of the craft, I think is contingent upon, you know, the passion behind it. And so my generation, you know, we were raised with pencils And I am very good with that tool. And I've been doing it so long that it's an extension. You know, I could literally put myself into a trance when I'm drawing. It's a beautiful thing. It's joyful. And the results, I think, would fall into the category of craft. Now, you know, the younger generation, I talked to a student last night and her face lit up talking about, you know, just entering that digital world. And she just can't wait to learn about it. You know, it's like, yeah, I can draw on this and that, but I can't wait to do digital, whatever that means. And I could tell that, you know, she's motivated, which means she'll put in a lot of hours, a lot of practice, you know, developing a proficiency, a language, a vocabulary, a fluency, you know, with digital medium. Whether the outcome is craft or not remains to be seen. But the enthusiasm would suggest to me, you know, I could predict that it would be craft. And so I just want to make sure, at least that's the page I'm on. You know, craft has an emotional component to it that doesn't care about the tool that gets you to that point. You know, Rich Fairborn turns wood vessels. I get one every year for my birthday. Now, he can afford a 3D printer, and he could probably produce amazing vessels with lace and this incredible complexity. But he chooses to do it with his hands. Why? Because he probably goes into a trance too. And so it's a very personal thing, you know, this subject matter. And I can't judge, you know, whose tool is the best. All I admire is anyone with any tool is able to get into that zone that produces craft.
So the actual experience of the architecture, whether it's a component or whether it's a space, that may not be that good quality, because the craft is kind of missing of the assembly, of the integration, of the materiality, because mm-hmm. that kind of level of thought hasn't gone into it. So to me, that's the kind of key difference that I do see, especially with those students in particular that are starting early. And there is a fear of drawing by hand. So I think that's the other thing that I see a lot, that the perception is now that if you draw by hand, it must be beautiful. And so that's actually really
not. What's wrong with that?
It's not that it's wrong to draw beautiful, but the problem is that if you haven't been drawing much, but you have ideas, the key thing is exploration and study that is not necessarily final or good is okay. Mm. But it's very hard for students to accept that in themselves, because when they do a study on the computer, it still looks pretty legitimate. You know, it doesn't look so bad. And so that's kind of part of the problem now with hand versus digital drawing for us in architecture is I encourage so much of what I call, you know, ugly drawing, because I think there's something about the thinking that goes on with some of that early sketching that you cannot do really on the computer still.
I'm going to disagree a little bit with what you're saying. One thing that's interesting is I'm teaching a second year studio at ASU right now. And the first exercise that we did had a lot of hand drawing. And I was shocked they could draw. I mean, they could really draw. Some of these kids were amazing. I did not expect that.
That's great.
But yeah, I was really, really surprised, really pleasantly surprised. I'm going to get to the digital part in a second, where I don't think the computer or the technology is to blame. And I'm not sure if that's kind of what you were saying about people getting into it really early. But I think that craft is something that is a motivation. It's a real drive, and it can be meditative. Mm-hmm. I think when I think of craft, one of the first things that I think of is Japanese carpentry, for instance, or calligraphy, and, you know, all of these different aspects of what they do is, I think, is very meditative. It's very slow. Mm-hmm. And
you know, when you see some of the calligraphers just draw so extremely, extremely slow. And there is a real desire, and I think you were calling it passion, mm-hmm. for that final product to be as perfect as it can possibly be. And given that, I think that, you know, one can do that with digital means. I'm not super huge into computers. I fought it off as long as I could before I started using them. But in a lot of our, particularly in our public art, we use quite a bit of digital practice, Grasshopper and Rhino and whatnot. And I work with a really great guy named Sherwood Wang, who has worked for a couple of people in town, including Colab Studio at one point. And he's got his own studio called Pattern Studio. And we work together all the time now. And so I'll give him some sketches and some thoughts. And he will use that digital medium to do things that I would never be able to actually produce by hand, even at least not within, say, a month of, you know, doing it 10 hours a day kind of thing. And we go back and forth and we really craft that all the way into being what we want it to be. And there can be a lot of craft with that. One example that's in the Richard Sennett book, The Craftsman, is he says that in technology, he finds an example of one of the best forms of craft in today's world. And that is with Linux, the free, you know, online platform or operating system. There are millions of users of Linux that are constantly trying to improve on it and make it as perfect as it can be. And so one of the things that's interesting about that is that it's many, many people actually putting the craft of that together with a drive that's a group effort, which is really interesting. So I think that although computers, and I don't disagree with you in any way, shape or form, Marlene, when it comes to the lack of quality of buildings because of the way that computers are used in general. I mean, Revit has really, I mean, you could see it when AutoCAD really took over what the buildings were, you know, made with. And now you can see it with Revit, in my opinion. I know everybody uses Revit and we do too, but it definitely has lowered, I think, a sense of craft in the world for architects in general, which is unfortunate. But I think there's examples of people doing great things with technology that do find really good craft.
So I want to touch on a couple of things that you guys are speaking about. It goes back to what Marlene was just saying about the quality of drawing and of what it means to create an ugly drawing, like a process drawing, to think through drawing. And I think that might be one of the biggest ways that I could draw a distinction between analog and digital processes, which are that the ugly drawing, the analog, you're able to work through things and kind of mess it up, and your hand can manipulate the pencil, the media, whatever you're using in a way that can allow your brain to feel it and think it through. Whereas as soon as you go into the computer, you have to type in a command or you have to use a function. You have to start working within the framework that the tool provides. And so I think to me, what's interesting about that is the tool is almost starting to drive the way you think. It's almost like the way language works, in that like language is a framework for how we think and communicate with each other. A tool can also be a way that we think and communicate with each other. And the freeness of that can actually distinguish where we take an idea. It's a lot easier to go many different places with a drawing that starts on a piece of paper and a pencil. There are more distinct, what I'll call commands that you have to input into a computer that will drive where it goes next. And I think maybe that's one of the ways where it's hard to build up a craft digitally, because there's actually more ways that you have to break the tool that you're using to actually get what you want out of it. What do you think about that?
Again, I think we're conflating a couple of things. You know, when Matt was speaking, he was talking about drawings and you know, hand drawings and digital drawings as a communication tool. And ugly drawings, you know, I've seen some ugly drawings, but the only ugly drawings I've ever seen were the ones that were trying to to communicate something to somebody else. The drawings that I see that are part of the process are always beautiful, and it's personal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a pencil as a thinking tool, as opposed to a computer as a thinking tool. Now, in my generation, even myself, I can think with a pencil. Of course, Todd and Billy can think with, you know, because they write about it very eloquently. But it would be foolish to think that someone can't think with a computer also. And I'll give you an example. When we were at the conference, you were there. And the woman that won the Oscar for fashion costumes went through her, and she did it so, you know, without any pretension. And, you know, she started out drawing, and I remember seeing her first dresses, you know, that she used, you know, parametric equations, produce these beautiful patterns and 3D print these dresses that I'm assuming were unwearable. You snap them on and stand there for the photograph, and then you unsnap them. But she kept going, and she was able to, and I'm sure I've got this, I'm not speaking accurately about this, but somehow she pixelated a butterfly wing and discovered how to make the 3D printing a malleable fabric. The outcome was incredible. You know, so, you know, if a person, you know, produces work on a computer and it lacks craft, well, it's because it lacks passion. Mm. And but this woman and her generation, you know, few people within her generation will exceed our craft with their new craft based on parametrics and equations. There's something beautiful about mathematics. It exists. It has always existed. It existed before people started walking upright. It was there. It was the universe. It was the laws of the universe. And the voice of those laws is math. It's not English. It's not, you know, Arabic. It is math. And so we just, as the decades go by, we discover, you know, that voice of nature. And with the computer, I mean, that's what I love about it. It's able to take the complexity that's built into that voice and use it as a design tool. And I'm very excited about it. There's a question here about authorship. I mean, it's math. Come on. I mean, and from Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, one of the most well-known architects that ever lived, you know, there's a reason there's a 45-degree angle in his drawings or a 30-60 angle in his drawings, because that's what his triangles were. There was a limitation to his compositions based on his tools, just like there are limitations or possibilities based on, you know, the computer.
Marlene, what do you think about some of the ways that people have been reacting to your original comment? And I think one thing I wanted to say about it is that what you were getting at least to me, was that you felt like there is a hesitation among younger architects, younger designers, to be allowed to do things that are not finished, that are incomplete.
I think that there's a couple things. One is the perception of a sketch now, I think, is still different for some people than it was when, you know, I started. And so the perception that a sketch is resolved and something has to be make sense. You know, frankly, there's a lot of what we do in architecture that, you know, is just thinking and showing our thinking in the drawing. So I do not think that there is a limitation on craft quality or the success of the project based on the media. But I think that right now, because of the status of the media in most firms, that's two different things, and how it's used and how much of the alternative media is available in the firm. You know, we have a lot of different programs in our firm, but for smaller firms, it's fairly unusual to have the range of program types that we have, and to also allow the time to implement them. That's another thing that's happened with practice, right? Like there's some speed problems for the study. So those people don't have time to learn that program unless they do it someplace else. But the most important thing is the idea about craft and skilled assembly is really about us as human beings. Mm-hmm. It's not about right or wrong in my mind. Mm-hmm. It's about everything's changing around us. Our tools are changing. Our tools are increasing and improving. But as human beings, what is good in terms of a spatial quality? What really is compelling in terms of a place to be for people, for communities, and the expression of a plane or the expression of a space? Those are all still as important as they were from time at the beginning. And so to me, the portion of craft is, how can we still implement those kinds of detailed look at our surfaces, at our spatial configurations, our proportions, and use digital technology to actually allow us to have more flexibility? That's what I find. Hmm. However, to clarify what I'm saying is that I do teach, and I have, you know, beginning, you know, new graduates, and I see that there is, you know, a real potential issue with skill with some of these 3D programs that, you know, the thing looks pretty good on the screen, but it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense in any depth. Mm-hmm. And you need to just, you know, I stop them and I say, here's what's fantastic about this. Now, before you go anywhere else, just look at this corner. You know, mm-hmm. What is this corner really saying about this project? And that's really, as human beings, I go back to the human being part. Why do we care about craft? Because mm-hmm. It affects the quality of what the place that we're in and how we see it and how it's put together affects the quality of where we are. And that's what we want to do as architects, ultimately, have good places to be. So that's the piece that I think is frankly just reality for us right now. You know, you can have very skilled 3D models done. But they're very lacking sometimes in, you know, anything that's making sense inside, to the point where sometimes like things don't like connect, they don't match up, mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing.
Does that speak at all to the role of curriculum and education about what in architectural education, about what we are taught in our, you know, 4 or 5 year programs, what have you? About what gets emphasized, and then also to touch what I mean by that is, like you're talking about people having to be trained in these programs. Mm-hmm. There's a fluency that you have to achieve in any tool to be able to begin to craft with that tool, and not everyone is able to achieve that level of fluency, and yet that's the reality of practicing in architecture these days. Is there an issue at all in education that's part of the paradigm of becoming an architect now?
You mean the instruction in the tools?
I guess you have a finite amount of time in which to become, achieve a degree in architecture. And yet now you need to learn all of these other programs in order to become fluent in the tools that you have to use to practice. Is that a problem at all for education, or is there an issue and emphasis within education? Or
I don't know why that there is such a very prevalent questioning about architectural education in the last 10 years, I'd say. You know, there's a lot of questioning about what's the purpose, you know, what is the ultimate result, etc. My point of view is this, that the educational component of our professional training is about learning to think, evaluate, explore, make excellence. And so to me, the time for program development is not a barrier at all. I mean, typically, we're not talking of having to learn 5 programs, you know, maybe 2 or 3. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that to be a barrier at all. I think the fundamentals of what we're doing is going back to like my statement about being a human being. Mm-hmm. You know, architecture is still important because as human beings, we exist in spaces. Mm-hmm. And so it's still extremely important for what is that space like? And so to me, the continued perceived challenge of architecture programs that they need to be something else, I don't think is necessarily rooted in the fact that they don't have to be something else. Some of the tools might have to be changed, But what is the quality of a space? Are they teaching proportion? We still have to teach proportion mm-hmm. and materiality and craft and spatial connection.
I think the overriding issue with education and with the profession to a degree and the lack of quality comes down to, as you alluded to it, that the schedules have gotten shorter, right? As mm-hmm. we've gotten more productive, the schedules have gotten smaller. I think the priorities that we have as societies or civilization, whatever you want to say, or as human beings, have gotten changed to have a craft for finance. And it's all about trying to find ways to make more money, you know, make it happen more. And so the tools that we are given as architects are in that vein where they want cut and paste, you know, kind of work so that we can meet the schedules. And frankly, I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say this, but ASU is one of the biggest culprits. I mean, they are driving the speed of schedules and everybody kind of follows their firm. Oh, shoot, ASU, look at what Jones Studio did with that building, you know, in 9 months or whatever. And that, you know, that mentality is really dangerous from the standpoint of craft and creating great spaces like you're talking about. And it gets into education as well. I mean, you guys all know that they are putting twice as many students through each studio. Because, you know, architects don't give money back to the school. It's not making them money. So the whole art school, you know, art school is like that. So I have 24 students in my studio and you don't have time to give desk credits. We don't have time to do reviews, not like the standard kind of reviews that you would have. You don't get those critiques.
Are you the only teacher?
Yes, sir.
24 students?
Yes, sir.
Design studio.
Yep. And so it is a really interesting challenge of what's happening. And again, this goes back to that craft of finance. It's not about, you know, it's really not about creating the best education, right? I mean, if they were going to do that, you would definitely have less students per an instructor. So there is an issue with our priorities to put everything into finance, you know, at the risk and peril and quality, lack of quality and everything else. And I think that is just pervasive in everything that happens in the world for the most part. There are those people that don't care about that as much, you know, that are the craftspeople that want to see, you know, are just interested in the good work more than, you know, making millions of dollars. And, you know, I think you two are certainly in that, you know, in that vein too. I'm not saying I make a ton of money and you don't. I'm sure I make less than you guys do. What I'm saying is that there is a mentality, a counter mentality that the old kind of way of thinking in terms of architects have that artists still have, where you really don't care about time. And it is really just about making. And, you know, the project that Maria is working on, and I don't know if you've heard about this, epitomizes that. Maria really tries to turn her back on digital media as much as possible. She's only working in analog. She bought two copies of Don Quixote. I think it's 900 pages or something like that. And she is cutting it out line by line. And she has two copies so she can get the back side of the page. And she's taping it together into one long string. And she's been working on it for a year and a half on the weekends. And she's on page 36. And so it is an endeavor of, which is brilliant because it's like Don Quixote, you know, tilting at windmills and everything. It's a really neat piece of artwork. And it's really a kind of a counterculture, you know, in a way. Kind of endeavor. And I think that that to me is very inspirational from the standpoint of, you know, doing what you really want to do, what you feel is important because it is important to you. As mm-hmm. you said, it's personal. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think artists are sort of this counter place to, I think the world has gone towards an engineered world where everything is about efficiency. And I'm not speaking poorly of structural engineers and people like that. I'm talking about the idea that everything needs to be as efficient as possible. And the artists are really counter to that. And interestingly, as we have this craft of finance, the artists have, you know, gotten pushed further and further into the weird people category, you know, that most people don't understand anymore. And when any normal person sees a work of art that took a ton of time, or even if it just looks like it took a ton of time to produce, people are boggled by it. And they think it's amazing because they couldn't possibly imagine
spending the time.
Yeah, what the patience it would take. Yeah, I think it's interesting to me that you know, we are having this conversation, that is apparently it's interesting enough that we would all come here on a Saturday
with a roast beer.
Which we're out of. Could use another round. I'll buy.
We'll get there.
But I frankly consider it a privilege to be living through the cusp of the transition. You know, the transition is it will take a generation. That's why, you know, you can't expect next year, you know, it is an entire generation of transition. Whereas my heroes, architecture was always the same, you know, at least the production of it was always the same. And so I'm getting to see, you know, new possibilities. And for me, it's, I mean, I can easily talk about, you know, the digital world and its potential as a design tool. I just gave you an example of the woman that, you know, was able to tap into it. But for me, what I'm really looking forward to is assembly. You know, all the other industries, you know, have utilized this incredible potential of the digital age in producing things. But architecture hasn't, you know, we're still pouring footings and we're still, you know, hammering nails and we're this and that. And our buildings are static and then they have to be remodeled. So you tear them down and throw away, you know, it seems ridiculous. Whereas, you know, ships, airplanes, trains, I mean, everything that moves, you know, has moved into that. Well, cars, I mean, maybe the difference is the difference between a Tesla and whatever is out in that parking lot. I mean, it is night and day and what, how good it can be. Most of those cars were robotically assembled. Good idea, you know, and we can debate the economic implications of that. But then there's the Tesla that's so much more advanced than the analog cars. And so I can't help but be excited about that potential. And I can't help but be excited about, can you imagine what the architecture would look like and what the experience would be if we could assemble buildings and address those issues, those social issues and economic issues of adaptation. You know, that I think is the key, convertibleism and adaptation of architecture. You know, Matt, it's not only inevitable and you can question whether it's a good thing or not. I have to think it's a good thing. I am such an optimist. I believe that the human nature and the advancement of human beings is always, just outrageous. We're always thinking in our best interest as a, you know, global community. You know, we don't particularly act that way, but I look back in history, I think we're doing pretty good, you know, compared to what our great grandfathers and great grandmothers were doing. And so I'm all for it. I really am. I cannot, as old as I am, I'm old enough to know, do not resist the inevitable. And then look forward to the perfection of that inevitable.
I don't think it's really about a choice, though, Eddie. I don't think it's about saying whether digital is good or bad for me at all. I think it's really, really good. I mean, we are trying so many things because of what we can do digitally. Mm-hmm. And we're building things and testing things so quickly that I couldn't have done, mm-hmm. you know, 15 years ago, mm-hmm. that I can send a drawing out. I can have something fabricated. I can look at it. And I can feel it, mm-hmm. and I can do things mm-hmm. that we couldn't do before. That, to me, that's clearly a benefit. Mm-hmm. I think the reality for us right now, unfortunately, is some of the tools are clumsy. Let's be honest. Mm-hmm. So really, in terms of the evolution of programs, there's still a lot of evolution that has to occur for us to be able to get through and pull things and move things and really test things. And that's really all I'm seeing, frankly, is because we're at the beginning. Some of the tools are still a little bit clumsy.
Yeah.
And so What that means is there has to be a pretty high level person that's pushing for the investigation. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, it's not going to happen like typically at, mm-hmm. you know, with moving so fast through projects. If there's not a high level person on a team saying, yes, we're going to look at this and we're going to try this and we're going to see what happens, mm-hmm. then it's harder to do because now, you know, you're going to have to push back and say, it's going to take me a week and, you know, I'm going to miss the deadline. And, you know,
look at the architects we admire the mm-hmm. most and how they produce the spaces that we admire the most. I mean, and I'm talking about current. You look at Peter Zumthor, mm-hmm. you know, no computer doesn't matter. And he doesn't do it on computer. His work is as good as it gets mm-hmm. and it's thoughtful and it takes a long time for him to get there. He's as slow right. as Glenn Murcutt, you know, which, he takes a long time to get there too. So, you know, my question is, will we ever, is it possible for digital architecture to achieve that kind of emotional content in a space?
Absolutely. And again, I don't, you know, as we were talking about, it comes from the passion and the desire mm-hmm. for the end result to be crafted. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, as you said, it doesn't, Marlene, it doesn't take, it doesn't matter whether it's digital or it's hand or whatever, it is the drive of the person. It is inevitable that something will move you that way. I'm mm-hmm. assuming you haven't seen one that has.
Have you?
I'm trying to think about mm-hmm. that. There are some that have gotten close.
Like one. And I'm not challenging him.
No.
Because I agree with you. Yeah. I can't wait.
Shop architects yeah. have done a really good job with the digital production. And one of the things that they're doing two high rises in New York. I think one's in Brooklyn and one is in New Jersey. I can't remember. But there's two. There's the Sliver Building.
That one's in Manhattan.
By Central Park. And in both cases, they did something that I thought was really thoughtful, not in the same way we're talking about with Zumthor, for instance, or Murcutt in the same way. But they did some things that were really clever, where they took details of columns and parts of classical buildings that were nearby and digitally reproduced them and then made them, you know, change as they go mm-hmm. up on the high rise. And it really beautiful. I mean, really, really beautiful. There's I cannot remember the name of the firm. It's out of Holland and they are, I think it's Rijtlig Nootling or something like that. I can't pronounce it, even if I could see it in front of me. But anyway, they have a number of buildings where they have brought ornament into mm-hmm. their buildings in really creative ways. And often they work with artists to provide something that that they can take the time to do something mm-hmm. in a thoughtful way, because that's what artists do. But anyway, they've done some really interesting work, too, with digital production. So, I mean, I think it's starting. And I think shop mm-hmm. firms like, you know, shop are kind of pushing that envelope. And that's what we need. Like, you need it in-house. You need it in your office. Somebody that's kind of driving that craft, ship in a particular direction. But we need it in a practice wise that we can look at and say, holy cow, people are really pushing this and inspire other people to do the same thing.
But I think so far it's all eye candy. You know, it's very interesting work and it's like, you know, it gets our attention. But then when I go in, you know, and that's the final test, you go in and experience the spaces. And if you're left cold, then, okay, we're not there yet, but someday we will get there. I fully believe we will get there. In fact, we have no choice, you know, but to get, you know, sort of get on board and bring, I mean, I won't be the one to do it, but the youngest among us, you know, will bring that sensibility of craft with them. Again, it's an outcome, not part of the process.
So one of the things that is not digital, but it can be digital, a component of digital, when we talk about craft and quality mm-hmm. and walking in, right? It's about what is that assembly really like? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to use the word proportion. Mm-hmm. So right now, the fact of the matter is, as again, I'm going to go back to the human being, right? As human beings, the proportion, the connectivity, the way spaces are as they connect to each other is important. And that kind of evaluation can be really amazing digitally, right? And you really couldn't do it with hand drawing, right? Mm-hmm. I think right now we have to catch up and use the digital tools to be able to teach that and evaluate it and look at it, you know, especially for beginners. I'm still, you know, going back to the beginner part, right? Because if we don't teach, it's not just about spatial interest. Mm-hmm. It's about spatial quality, mm-hmm. The proportionality, getting out and being in places, mm-hmm. studying, okay, what made this really work for me? And looking at what the qualities are dimensionally, proportionally, et cetera. That to me is fantastic for digital modeling, mm-hmm. because we can actually see that now where we, you know, not totally, but we can see it more than we could have, say, 20 years ago.
How do you explain then the work that came out of the University of Oklahoma when Bruce Goff was dean? It was all orthogonal projection. It was all analog. And spatially, the spatial interest that was produced not only by Goff, but by many of his students without computers, without parametric equations. Absolutely. I mean, it was amazing work. Most of it never got built. But I'm not going to let the digital community own interesting spaces, complexity. They can't own complexity because it's been around, and we were able to produce it without a digital meaning.
My comments are not about what was never done, mm-hmm. and what is done now. Mm-hmm. My comments about a continuity, mm-hmm. and a potential for alternative ways to look at spaces that are helpful. Mm-hmm. It's, of course, there were amazingly and still are wonderful spaces done analog. I mean, you know, most everybody I trained with did amazing things and knew how to study them, new proportion. So nothing about what I'm saying is about something is actually better or worse. It's about potential, and it's about potential use. And for me, I think that there is that potential for showing a client something that I can show them before it's built in a way. And I can kind of walk through something with some of the junior staff and say, now let's just move through this and think about what we're seeing when we do this, just to talk about proportion and continuity and scale. And I'm just using the tool, mm-hmm. and it's helpful. Mm-hmm. And yes, I still did that when I was quickly drawing sections and quick, not to scale perspectives, but it's nice sometimes to have another tool, which is really fun.
And for I think one of the things that we've touched on with regards to craft is that it takes iteration. It takes somebody looking at it over and over again, reflecting on it. That crafting something does not mean a one-off. It means committing to it, mm-hmm. as you said earlier. So one of the benefits, I guess you could say, to digital tools is the ability to iterate quickly. To iterate through many designs quickly to see them before they get built, so you don't have to build and then say, oh, we should have done this differently for this reason or that reason. So, but is there, I guess, to contrast against that, is there an issue again with speed if you iterate quickly but aren't able to reflect to the same depth? Is there an issue there at all? Or are you able to work through problems so quickly that you can get the best answer out faster than you ever could if you had not had those tools in front of you?
It's an interesting subject. Get the best answer. But just because you have the best answer doesn't mean it's going to be refined. And that's, at least for me, where slowness comes in. I feel like I'm in a disadvantage, Sean. I don't know what it feels like to produce a refined detail on a computer. I don't have that experience. I damn sure know what it feels like with a pencil and tracing paper. And it brings me joy to do that. You know, so I'm not about to trade that, you know, for future possibility because like I said, I can put myself into a trance and,
You can do that with a computer.
Well, there you go. See, you know, Matt knows what it feels like and I don't, but
Didn't say it was a good trance.
Are we still talking about architecture?
Yeah, I mean, drafting on the computer, you can, I think you know how to use the computer. Yes. And you draft with it, right? I mean, you definitely can get lost working on details. Mm-hmm. And drawings. And what is interesting, too, is that the way you can zoom in and out on, mm-hmm. The drawing, let's mm-hmm. call it, whether it's a model or an AutoCAD drawing, it enables you to actually do the whole damn thing and, you know, bigger than life scale kind of thing. And so I find myself, you know, I'm like, okay, I need to figure this detail out and I'll start drawing before I know it. I'm like doing the whole building, you know, I'm like, wait, stop. Mm-hmm. I don't need all of this. Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing for me. And they know, you know, they've done studies about the brain hand connection, mm-hmm. right? That mm-hmm. there's a particular kind of connection that happens there that we don't have with the mouse. Mm-hmm. And so it is different, but I would challenge you though to, you know, it is different and it's, I don't even know if I want to say that drawing is better. Drawing was definitely my first love.
Mm-hmm. You're very good at it.
Oh, thanks. But I don't know that I love it more than mm-hmm. the computer or vice versa. I don't want to say that right now because I don't know that I've explored the computer enough in the same way that I've explored drawings. Mm-hmm. But I would challenge you to actually try to learn it and see what it's like. Sure. And experience it because it really is, the craft is there, you know, inside of you.
But I think we should make this point that you learned the language of pencils. You learned how to express your ideas with analog. And you were born at the right time and your parents had enough money. And so you got into the computers and you weren't. You weren't, you know, solidified in analog. You know, you were open to, you know, the possibilities of the digital medium, and you're really good at that too. But I think you have an advantage in that you learned the pleasures of drawing, and you've reinterpreted those digitally. I know Brian Farling has too, and the guys that are younger than him.
I'm here too.
I'm not as close. I don't spend my time in your office, so I don't get to directly look at things. That's why I didn't mention it, Marlene. But I look at the younger people that did not have the training in analog, and their digital drawings, you know, I have to say they suck. You know, they're not communicating any spiritual qualities to me. I wasn't talking about you, Sean. You're a damn good draftsman too. Gotta have to be careful. Yeah, step on toes here.
That is a like the professional kind of there is a professional change happening right amongst mm-hmm. firms, and I think mm-hmm. in terms of what is the focus, because in order to encourage that and not, you're gonna, sometimes the reward aspect is hard to explain, especially to staff, right? And it's not about check, it's done. So for me, is actually that's the least of the issues for me. It's about, did you think about it? Did you look at what you drew when you drew it? Did you see that there was something that could have been better? And then test it and then ask. I think that that's part of the challenge with those that are just doing computer drawings, because mm-hmm. it looks legit. It does look legit. I mean, it's got four walls. I'm simplifying. Mm-hmm. And in school, you can do very well in really good programs with very interesting spatial depictions that may not have any real study about proportion, scale, materiality, really. You know, that we did like years ago, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's the mix that, you know, part of it is, then you might say, gosh, the analog was better. But I don't know if it's the analog thing. I just think we need to bring that back in, that qualitative segment about how we put the spaces together. And to me, especially going back to the school thing, for me in school, you know, I'm really less worried about whether the beam is the right size and the column hits it exactly right. Because That's what we will teach them mm-hmm. in practice. Mm-hmm. That's what the practice part is for, in my opinion. So in the school, that's where we can start addressing this thinking, because mm-hmm. if they've gone through 6 years of school and that aspect of, you know, really looking at that digital drawings, like you looked at your hand drawing and saying, does this have any potential spatially, qualitatively, mm-hmm. materially wise? You know, does it have any interest? Does it move? What's going on with the shadows? Things like that. That's the part maybe we can think about thinking, how do we integrate that more forcefully and programmatically, so that when you're starting, it's not about you're just introducing those ideas. There's students that can go through their whole program and they haven't had that kind of mm-hmm. discussion, I think.
Frankly. Well, they removed all of the art from the curriculum in architecture school. The NCARB came through and wiped that part out and replaced it with computer software teaching. And the reason why they did that is that firms, especially the big firms, were complaining that the students were coming out of school and weren't making them enough money. They were not productive enough. They didn't know how to use the software well enough. And so removing that really did, I think, an injustice to the standpoint of thinking and understanding a level of craft. As I mentioned, the students that I've got right now are shocked that, you know, at least half of them drew really well. I was really surprised. And I asked them where they got those skills. And they said, you know, I've had a little bit of sketching. You know, we did a little bit of sketching last year and first year kind of thing. It's like, okay, but this is, you couldn't have done this in a semester even, you know? And so mm-hmm. there's still drawing going on, but it's not an architecture school. Mm-hmm. I can't agree with you more about the understanding of being able to step back and look at what you're doing. And I think, like Eddie was saying, for me, you know, going to art school, I had years of training of it. And knowing how to draw and or paint and go back and look and problem solve, you know, a little bit at a time and working on a painting for 2 weeks or whatever. And not having that part of the education, I think, does the entire world an injustice. And I think the other side of it, too, with a lot of the buildings that are done that I think are horrible proportion wise, are a lot of it is about just creating the new and the fascination with the new, you know. And it's amazing how many Rem Koolhaas buildings I've been to and just said, there's nothing about human about this. There's the library in Seattle is a perfect example.
Thank you.
It is a horrible, horrible building. And from the public's sense, yeah, there are some thrilling things going on inside and whatnot, but it is completely devoid of anything really human in it to me, besides just a few little moments on the inside that are squishy or soft or curved or whatever, which is still kind of like, yeah, who cares, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there is a big aspect of the, you know, being the fascination of the new, hey, we've got new tools, what can we do with it? And people are sort of throwing those things out. And I think we'll get past that stage, I hope. And that, you know, people will start remembering, you know, what really matters. And I think I think that's starting to come back. I mean, I kind of get a sensibility of that from these young students. I'm hopeful for that.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about architectural education. And that's an important subject for sure. I talk about it all the time. I'm kind of tired of talking about it. What I think this topic is about, though, are the buildings that are being produced these days. And that's why I ask you, give me an example of a digitally produced building that I can go see and have it get under my skin. There's a building in Los Angeles, The Broke. And when I saw it published, you know, the plans, the sections, the diagrams, man, this is a great building. Now we finally have something that was only possible, you know, through the computer. And so I went there and it left me cold, you know.
Streetscape. Yeah.
Well, even the interiors, I mean, it should have been great. Ascend into the luminous room. And it was dead. Mm-hmm. It didn't have a heartbeat.
And there's some surprising aspects of it that make it dead, that you think, okay, this is observable, in the model, mm-hmm. you know, those kinds of things. Now we're going to get back to still the speed problem and the kind of delivery issue with our profession, which doesn't have to do with the craft and the analog and digital thing. But that's part of what I think leads to that, because I think they could have taken it to that level, mm-hmm. Eddie, really. Mm-hmm. Something happened, right?
I couldn't put my finger on it.
Something
though.
Happened. Mm-hmm. But let me go now to something, say, maybe, you know, at the low scale, which is something that's happening a lot for me right now, is that because of our digital documentation, which we were one of the first to do full on 3D documentation. So we've been doing this a long time. And the things that I can do now with component testing, I could not do when I started my practice. And I can call this, if I can negotiate a contract for construction, which some of my projects we can do, right? Not me, but the client has it pre-negotiated. I have a subcontractor I can work with, and they're typically qualitative, you know, they're of a quality where they have digital shop drawing development, and I can send them an idea on a steel fabrication that I want to do in a building, and they will give me an opinion. And they'll send me a suggestion back mm-hmm. in a day. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't do that in the old drawing ways. I mean, they would have sketched it out, but it wouldn't have been calculated, and I wouldn't have the depth, and I wouldn't see what it was. And now I can get it back, and Mike in my office can figure out, Marlene, if we do this, you know, this depth of this thing, I got the screw I can't use. And, you know, we're just doing that in like 10 minutes, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is so fun.
It is absolutely that's
amazing. Yeah. And well, we did this exhibit last week, and really I just had most of my exhibit was about that collaboration with the trades that mm-hmm. I can do. And it's really about sharing digital modeling mm-hmm. With RC Lurie. You know, we did mm-hmm. digital testing of the lighting and the attachments and stuff. And I mean, he built the samples in 3 days. No, like
so. Well, I'm glad you mentioned all of this, because that's probably the most direct benefit that even we feel. And this detail that I did on these countertops at Jones mm-hmm. Studio, water jet cutting, mm-hmm. design it, computer, here's the disc, boom, it's what, and it is so fine. I mean, the tiny little point, it goes to zero. Imagine what that would have, you know, taken, you know, 10 years ago.
It's digitally crafted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
Amazing.
And I have no anxiety about authorship. I mean, it's just a beautiful thing.
Well, I mean, you guys have touched on so many of the topics that I want to talk about. We've somehow already talked for almost an hour, so we only have a little bit of time left. There are two more things I want to make sure we talk about with this. And it's really these last two questions that I've got on here. So the first one we've touched on a lot, and I just wanted to read a little bit of this quote about speed from Todd Williams and mm-hmm. Billy Sand. And I won't read the whole quote, but I will read what I think is the most powerful parts, which are that our desire to continue to use the tools of the hand, even as we may begin to use the computer, has to do with their connection to our bodies. As our hands move, we have the time to think and to observe our actions. When we make changes, they occur with effort and a fair amount of tedious scrubbing with erasers, erasing shields, and spit. So decisions are made slowly after thoughtful investigation because they are a commitment that has consequence. It is better to be slow. In the context of what we've been talking about today, how does that fit within the way our practices work now and the speed at which we need to produce, the construction schedules, the tools we use, et cetera? I mean, there are certainly things that conflict here at times, and we have to wait.
But Sean, it's because we're in the cusp. I mean, I know exactly what she's talking about. I live there. I've been living there my whole life. And like I say, it is a source of joy for me. But with all due respect to Billy, only a fool will resist the potential for what lies ahead. I mean, nobody more than me loves that quote, but I am never going to stand in the way of what's possible from now, because somebody someday, 50 years from now, will be having another podcast, and maybe they'll reference back to the old days of digital design, you know, and it was so much, I don't know, more touchy-feely than it is now. Who knows? But the guy that chiseled, you know, into a stone tablet probably thinks, you know, God, you're missing all that, you know, getting hit in the eye with a piece of stone, I mean, cutting your fingers off. It's all relative.
I think it's also not, it is relative. That's fairly specific. And for me, I think that I tend to think that there's going to be hand work that we do over time. I hope we never stop being able to use our hands. So that would imply that we're not going to use our hands anymore at some point, which I hope doesn't happen. There's things that I can do super much faster by hand. I can do conceptual thinking 100 times faster by hand. I can race through things so fast, I'll never be able to do it on the computer right now. Okay, maybe eventually the computer will have sketching tools that are like my hand, but still, guess what? It's not going to actually be any faster because I can still do it super fast by hand. But the majority of the stuff past the early conceptual thinking is way faster on the computer. The thing that's missing is you got to keep on acting like it's done by hand and pushing it. And that's the thing I hope that we get better.
Can I ask you a quick question? Are you more comfortable speaking English or Armenian?
English.
Okay. You probably learned Armenian first.
Right. It was my first language.
Okay. But now, English is, you're more comfortable with English.
Yes.
So,
but I don't think the analogy is right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So like we can speak 10 languages and be fluent in all of them. And we can be really fluent in analog and digital drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that the work is going to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what I'm saying.
Good point.
And so I think that we don't have to make a decision about right or wrong. The thing that I find is some of the freedom of conceptualization is not that easy right now on the computer. And so part of the challenge for me is to encourage, especially beginners, is it's okay for you to test something by hand. Do something on a piece of sketch paper, test it, and then see what you think.
So bilingual is always the best way to be, right?
No, I mean, there's really good architects that only know English. That's okay.
I'm still using a metaphor. So,
there is something to be said about fluency through tools and the way that that fluency might inform our thinking. So certainly the more fluent we get, the more that should inform our thinking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a maybe even not too distant in the future that there would be a tool that, you know, you put a couple of pads on your forehead and it, because I don't know if you saw it, there was a really interesting piece that I saw that they had somebody hooked up to they had people hooked up to different electrodes on in their brain.
Yeah.
And they showed them a bunch of photographs. And then later they talked to them about those photographs and the computer was showing what they were thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see pieces of those images. Their mind was trying to put those images together. So I do think that eventually there will be a moment where there might be a way to throw ideas out, you know, that are even faster than quick sketches that we can do, which is crazy. I think, you know, the slowness that she's talking about, there is the body part of it, right? There's the not body part of it that I think we've been talking about, that is just taking the time to actually want to see the craft be done. And I think in that essay, and I saw her speak at, you know, a few years ago at ASU on the subject, and I was very moved by it. But I think a lot of it is the point of using the hand in all of these ways to force yourself to take the time in a way. I definitely think there is something about the body as a component, but I also I think very much like Marlene in that when you get fluent in the other tools, it starts to get there, you know, anyway. So I think I love the thoughts, I love the essay, and I actually try to find ways to live it in certain ways to slow down the way that I work on purpose, in order to force more thought. But I don't think using the body is the only way to do it. And I also think, again, it has to come down to what you believe in. And they really do believe in their craft. And so they, you know, I think they could do it on the computer.
Let me pose a question to you, and I'll go back to Rich and his turned vessels. Hunk of wood, a disc, and the lathe turns a beautiful wooden vessel, thin, perfect. You take that and you put it over here. Then Rich takes another hunk of wood and he turns it himself and he runs his hands over and the oil moves in, and it's pure love and it takes him 10 times as long. And then you put that there. I suppose they look the same. Which has more value?
You know, it's funny you say that. I was just in Austin and I was staying with two friends, and one of them has this tool that he uses to make decisions. And so when they're picking a piece of furniture, he will ask his girlfriend, okay, well, which one has more life?
Mm-hmm.
And I like that way of thinking about it too. And so you can be holding even identical things and ask yourself that question. And I think it is really interesting. I know exactly what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I've seen, you know, Matt Jabot, for instance, mm-hmm. who is a great metal worker, probably the best in town. I don't know all of them, but I'm guessing that he probably is. Anyway, I've seen things that he's done with his hands I didn't think were possible. You know what I mean? And so there's definitely a matter of being able to produce things by hands. It doesn't take digital, it doesn't take water jet cutting and stuff like that, I think, to get some of those forms. It's just a matter of speed in its essence. Is there more life in it? Is there more character in it? Is there more value? I think
that's a great word, life. James Hubble once said, you know, it's possible to make a silk rose, a perfect silk rose that you cannot tell it's not real. And then you put it next to a real rose and they look the same.
But you can tell.
But the fact that this one will die gives it far more value than this one that will never die. And so that quality of limited existence, maybe that's the topic, you know, that distinguishes, you know, digital conversation versus analog conversation.
I feel like time is something that's come up far more in this conversation than I thought it was going to. But time is a big part of how we think about craft and the value we attach to that craft, it seems, as well.
Except that Marlene has talked a lot about the life and the beauty and the humanity of what's there too. And I think that
nobody can give me an example of a building.
Not yet.
It's coming, right. Though. Not yet. Not That's yet. True. I will be open-minded. Absolutely.
Well, after we're done, I'll tell you to go someplace.
Okay? Is it hell?
I'm going to tell you a project to go to in town.
Okay. Okay.
But I don't want to talk about it on thing, but because I really want you to go there. And I want to know what you think,
okay.
You know, because part
Deal.
Of the reason why it happened is because of what we were able to do with a contractor digitally. And then the suggestions they made with prefabricating actually assemblies that never would have happened if we would have done it the old fashioned way. And you can say it's maybe the building isn't as, you know, it's not as good. It's not, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, but there's some good qualities to it. And so that would be as far as I'd want to go with, you know, just think maybe that.
And I think there's sort of, those are two different subjects, you know, using technology to produce components and test, prototype and test versus design space. And I'm all for utilizing technology to advance construction into the 21st century. You know, I keep wanting to assemble my buildings and I never get to. I'm always being forced to construct them. But you know, so I fully support of that. I'm sure I will admire your building wherever it is. There are firms in the world that, you know, rely on, you know, parametric equations to design buildings. And it's amazing what's possible. And that you can you know, hand that program to a contractor, and they don't have to worry about understanding it totally, because every piece of it is sized and you know, the robotic fabrication will do it to that size, and GPS will tell you where to put it in space, and it'll line up with this piece because GPS. Mm-hmm. And that's amazing too. But I'm just still waiting for that life. You know, when does it get its heartbeat? Mm-hmm. And it's not a fair comparison, because we've had centuries of building analog buildings, and you're pretty good at it. You know, I mean, you can just track it. But this is a whole new thing. You know, the technologically produced buildings, and it's yet to achieve that heartbeat yet.
There's a really interesting school in Germany, and I'm trying to, I think it's Stuttgart, but they have a class that every year they make something, and it's based on biomimicry. So that one of the pieces I'm thinking of was made out of coral, and it, I can't remember what it was constructed of. I think it was bent plywood, these forms that were kind of pillowy, and they attached them together and they made these beautiful forms. But there was another one that they made. They make a different pavilion every year. This other one I'm thinking of, you'll love this from a standpoint of technology. It was really amazing. So there was a parametrically designed steel frame that was very, very empty. And whatever the pavilion shape was, it was, I don't, you know, it's pavilion shaped. But the they actually spun a web through it around it using drones. So the drones were programmed to, yes, follow the parametric design, and it was amazing.
I mean, there was a swarm of them, right?
I don't know if it was one or a swarm, but I think it might have been two or something like that. But the intricacy of it was amazing. I mean, it was really beautiful. I don't know if it's like the broom, you know, where, mm-hmm, you go there and it's not that interesting, but it was pretty interesting in pictures. So They're getting closer, I think, on some of these things.
The thing about the Brogue is it's like kind of schoolwork in some way. I don't want to attack it because there's a lot of good things about it. But there's so many, craft-wise, there's pieces that are amazing, mm-hmm, right? Exactly. Craft, beautiful craft. But it's the spatial.
It's part. That it's the Venetian plaster part on the escalator, which is hand-done. That's beautiful.
So, yeah.
I do have one more, and just before we end, this has been a fantastic conversation. You guys have driven the conversation far more than I thought. So thank you for having compelling things to say and bringing those compelling things out of each other. This last one, I think, is just an important one, because you just touched on it, both of you guys, with regards to parametric modeling. And I think to a greater point, which is the introduction of data into architecture. And so this would be my last question, and this is contrasting with what I just talked about with slowness with Todd and Billy. This is from Patrick Schumacher, principal at Zaha Hadid Architects. I'd like to use, in this case, parametricism more about modern architecture of the last, say, 20 or so years, in which data has become a more integral part to the design of buildings. Parametricism succeeds modernism as a new wave of systematic innovation. Both in terms of techniques and in terms of sensibility, parametricist architecture is eager and able to elaborate adaptive responses to diverse environmental parameters. The breadth of information and our ability to integrate it into our work is constantly expanding and opening up new avenues for architects to make an impact on the world. Is there a sense of craft into the data that we're putting into our projects too? Is there, you spoke about how you could use the computer and you could use parametric design to gain a fluency over it and manipulate it in the ways that you want to. How does the overwhelming amount of data in our world now reinform craft and architecture that we practice day to day?
I think data can give decision substance. It can support a decision, a design decision or a programmatic decision. But there's a danger in just letting it drive the one's thinking. You know, once you remove the human being from it and just let the data drive things, I think you get stillborn buildings. I think it's wonderful that we have tools now that can produce data, but if you become a slave to it, you know, it's like if you become a slave to your 45 degree triangle or your parallel bar or your pencils or your, you know, Revit program, what is that program that students were using that just guaranteed their projects would suck? I can't remember the name of it, but you know, you cannot, by God, if you're going to be an artist, that comes with a set of responsibilities. And if you relinquish your responsibilities as an artist over to technology, then I don't know, you're kind of wasting my time. Does that answer your question? Maybe somebody else should respond.
We use a lot of data. We're doing a lot of data-based design. It's not, as Eddie, you know, said, it's not handing it over to the computer or to the data. There's always, you know, there has to be a sensibility, a human sensibility to it, no matter what. But the I'll give you a couple of examples of how data has really improved our craft. I've always been really interested in sustainability, but I didn't really understand how to use the data. I'm not good at that necessarily on my own. Austin Troutman, you know, my partner at Valley, he self-professed macro geek, you know, goes out and learns all of this technology, really knows the data, and then brings me the system. And then I craft that into architecture, but he crafts the system together to make it work extremely well without much extra cost and all these things. And it's amazing how much better the work that I feel like I'm able to produce because of all of this data and energy modeling and all of these different aspects of being able to study things and understand and drill down on, for instance, limiting waste by designing to the dimensions of all of the materials in a very precise way and looking at that in Revit and having Revit tell us how much, you know, we've got. So though in terms of craft, not in terms of human and you know, life and all of that. But in terms of craft, I feel like there's a lot of really great benefits that I have learned to really appreciate the data. I said I was going to give you two examples and I only gave you one.
You've never let go of your responsibility to do something that makes a community better.
No, but people that don't care about that are going to make boring buildings anyway, right? Mm-hmm. Or inhuman buildings. I mean, and people have always made inhuman buildings as well, right? The other one I was going to mention was the biophilic design, you know, because I was designing, you know, from a sensibility of a absolute love and appreciation for nature, and grew up with, you know, working for Eddie for 10 years, for instance, and with organic architecture and wanting to produce that. We all architects, I think, have an intuitive appreciation for what biophilic design is, but understanding, really drilling in and understanding specifically how to get the most benefit out of that has also improved my craft. So those are things that, you know, we can rely completely on intuition or we can rely on our experience. But the things that I'm finding with looking at data, it's enabling me to design smarter or better or more human. And so I think it can be very beneficial, and it just is how you use it.
The thing that I think about when you mentioned your partner too, is that one of the database benefits of digital elements in general are that we can also find an expert like really quickly, and we can integrate a data performance criteria evaluation, etc., in my work, like, again, like I couldn't do 10 years ago. That influences the work in a good way. It's not going to drive the work, but it influences the work in terms of its evaluation, like what you're doing, right? You're saying, okay, I don't have to learn how to do this in the long way that we used to do. And that's super beneficial. You know, there are claims out there that eventually we won't need to do art because there will be, you know, programs that will be creative brains. I don't tend to like go there. I'm not thinking that's going to be good. So I still think that we do need our own creative brains.
Yeah. Are you talking about as a society or as an individual?
As human beings.
Well, there are computers that are doing sports writing now, which I think is actually perfectly fine.
Might as
because,
well.
Yeah, exactly.
Who gives a shit?
The sports writing wasn't, you know, it generally has not been of, you know, extremely creative quality. There are a few, you know, standouts that way. But yeah, I agree with you. There always has to be, I mean, it probably will get to the point where it can channel, you know, Einstein and, you know, Picasso together or something weird like that.
I don't know.
But I right now, it's certainly not at the, I think it's scary to think that computers will be able to provide to humans what humans mm-hmm. can provide. I think it can get perfected and it might work someday. But yeah, right now it's pretty darn bad.
Well, you used the word intuition for the first time in this whole thing that word came up. And that's a beautiful word. And, you know, I've always had to rely on my intuition until recently that now I have access to data, you know, and it's comforting. You know, I like having that support mechanism, you know, where I can technically defend a decision because here is the information to do it. And maybe the question is, will technology fully replace intuition? If it does, I'm okay with that too, Marlene. Nobody will ever take away from me my ability to sit in a room by myself and draw, you know, and that's what feeds me. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to relinquish that because as the years go by, I become more and more antiquated. It's, I'm really okay with it. And I have to be an optimist, you know, that this is all going to produce another kind of world and the young people will adapt and exalt the potential and, you know, we'll just keep going.
I'm worried that if we take away intuition, you know, we know that we can't find our way around a town anymore mm-hmm. because we need our phones. Right. And so if we take away,
Well,
but you don't rely on Google Earth. And, but I'm saying that.
Correct.
But I'm saying that if we do remove intuition, if human beings don't have to do it anymore, and we lose that ability, I think that's quite dangerous. Mm-hmm. Just like losing the ability to communicate between two people and make a connection, right? Mm-hmm. And so, from that standpoint, you know, there are ways that the world is sort of moving in a particular direction that I think are not. I am not optimistic about. And I definitely think that there needs to be a balance. But I also am optimistic from the standpoint that I think that people around the world are waking up to that need for that balance and the need for connections and the need for nature. And I think that there is some swelling that's happening in various pockets that will spread and change the world for the better. That's my
I think there's so many good stories of industries that have, you know, become so much better, you know, because of technology. Animation, you know, and you talked about a world where, you know, we've given up intuition. What was the Pixar movie WALL-E mm-hmm. about two robots? No dialogue. But you knew exactly how these robots were feeling. You knew when they were falling in love, but they weren't speaking.
These English.
These anime, but that's my point. You know, through this digital technology, these animators were really give life to these drawings. Mm-hmm. And then there were all the fat people mm-hmm. that, you know, floated mm-hmm. around and never mm-hmm. had to do anything
again.
Movie,
yeah.
It was. But I see, you know, my optimism comes from seeing every other industry except architecture becoming, I don't know, more expansive.
It's funny you say that. I mean, I think architecture has gotten incredibly expansive.
Yeah, you know, we're still subject to gravity. We're still constructing buildings instead of assembling them, and
all of that's changing. I mean, I know, Matt.
I mean, that's why I'm optimistic. Wow. But we seem to be lagging behind. Artists are always a block ahead of architects.
Oh yeah, There, you know, and I think that's because there's so many different things that we have to, you know, the pragmatism side of things, mm-hmm. and all, there's a lot of different things that we have to take on. But one thing that's interesting is that you can look at how much more productive each of the industries are, and construction has actually gone down a little bit since the 1920s. And I think that has to do with OSHA, you know, to a degree, the why it went down and didn't just stay level. But there has been almost no change in the construction industry, you know, mm-hmm. in 100 years or close to it. And so that is definitely a place where I think there's got to be some change.
Well, we are past 3 o'clock.
And so, we're off topic now.
So we'll have to end. But thank you again for all of you to join us today. This is a really great conversation. I wish we could talk for 3 more hours because I'd love to hear everything you guys have to say. Thank you very much.
Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been our episode on craft, and I think we got a really good discussion and wide ranging from our guests. I want to thank Eddie, Marlene, and Matt for joining us and sharing their thoughts. I think that conversation went in ways we didn't even expect. We had a set of questions, and I think we got through half of them before the three of them just that conversation in a direction, you know, neither of us were expecting. And I think it really speaks to the passion that people have about this topic and what it means to our industry and how we practice as architects.
So please reach out, tracingarchitecture.org, and join in on the discussion with this episode. Like Sean was saying, there's a lot that we dug into here, and I think there's a lot that we can continue on this topic. Say if we get enough traction, we may end up doing another episode on this topic just to keep exploring.
I would love to do a follow-up episode on craft. I think we only barely scratched the surface with that one. And we talked for an hour straight, nonstop about it. And that was only with 3 people. So if you'd like to learn more about our podcast, or if you want to join the discussion, please join us on our website at tracingarchitecture.org. You can tell us your thoughts about what we're exploring, if we should explore something else. You can tell us we're doing a terrible job. You can tell us we're doing a great job. We appreciate any interaction we can get with our listeners.
I'd like to thank our sponsor, Pella Windows, for their generous support of the Tracing Architecture podcast. If you'd like to reach out with your own support, please visit us at tracingarchitecture.org or at tracingarchitecture@gmail.com for sponsorship opportunities.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you listen next time.